If you have Bibles with you, please turn to Paul's epistle to the Romans. Romans chapter 3, we'll be reading from verses 21 to 26. But now, the righteousness of God has been manifested apart from the law, although the law and the prophets bear witness to it. The righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. For there is no distinction, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as a propitiation by his blood, to be received by faith. This was to show God's righteousness, because in his divine forbearance he had passed over former sins. It was to show his righteousness at the present time, so that he might be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus.
Once again, we're delighted to have with us the author tonight of the Day One book on William Cowper, the evangelical poet. That's Paul Williams.
So I want to talk about the life of William Cowper, and I would really like to draw out some pastoral lessons at the end as well as during the course of it, I'm sure. With a heavy heart, the Reverend John Newton followed the familiar path. Cutting through from the vicarage into the garden of Orchardside, he arrived at the home of William Cowper and his companion, Mary Unwin. It was early in the morning on the 2nd of January, 1773. Only the day before, William Cowper had been out walking in the fields. Dark thoughts had come into his mind. He was convinced that he was about to fall into another period of depression. And arriving home, William immediately put pen to paper. And the words that he wrote have since become familiar words sung all over the world by Christian congregations all around the world. God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. And William Cowper couldn't have wished for a more faithful pastor or constant friend than John Newton, the curate of Olney. Well, at Berkhamsted Rectory on the 15th of November, 1731, Anne Cowper had just given birth to her fourth child, William. She and her husband, John, had already experienced the loss of three children. In fact, the only two children to live into adulthood out of seven children would be William and his younger brother, John, born 5 years later. Typical, I guess, for the times in which they were living. His father, Dr. John Cowper, was rector of Berkhamsted and a chaplain to King George II. On his father's side, on John Cowper's side, his grandfather, William Cowper's grandfather, Spencer Cowper, was a judge in the Court of Common Pleas. His grandfather's older brother, born in 1665, became the first Earl Cowper, and in 1702 was appointed the first Lord Chancellor of England. On Cowper's mother's side, his mother, Anne, her maiden name was Dunn, and she included in her ancestors, her family ancestors included the great English Puritan poet John Donne, and the family line stretched back, apparently, don't ask me to verify this, but apparently stretched back to Henry III and to Queen Anne Boleyn. The one event that changed William Cowper's life was the loss of his mother. Just before his sixth birthday, on the 7th of November, 1737, Anne gave birth to his younger brother John. She never regained her strength, and just 6 days later, aged 34, she died. Cowper never recovered from it. In fact, 47 years later, he commented that hardly a day passed when he did not think of her. And in fact, Cowper's later poetry suggests that She was a believing woman. She was a loving, tender-hearted, tender, affectionate mother. And yet in contrast, his father, Dr. John Cooper, comes across as hard and unfeeling, even on the day of her funeral. He told William to go upstairs to the nursery. He banished him to the upstairs nursery so that he wouldn't see the funeral hearse. And the grief for Cooper was to last his entire life. His mother's maids, actually, feeling for William, they foolishly, perhaps, promised that she would return again very soon, which really ultimately wasn't very kind at all. But that's what they, in their best of motives, I guess, that's what they said to him. And that she'd only gone away for a while and that she would come back. But even at 5 years of age, William Cooper knew more than that. And in 1788, at the age of 57, Cooper was given a portrait of his mother by his cousin, Anne Bodham, from Norfolk. His mother's family originated from Norfolk, and he didn't even know at that point that his mother's portrait existed. It was the first picture he'd seen, first sight of his mother, if you like, since he was 5 years old when she died. He was so moved that he wrote a poem, On the Receipt of My Mother's Picture Out of Norfolk, in which he recalls his feelings on the day of the funeral. He writes, My mother, when I learnt that thou wast dead, say, wast thou conscious of the tears I shed? Hovered thy spirit o'er thy sorrowing son, wretch, even then, life's journey just begun? Perhaps thou gav'st me, though unseen, a kiss, perhaps a tear, if souls can weep in bliss. Ah, that maternal smile, it answers yes. I heard the bell tolled on thy burial day. I saw, from the window, you see, he was looking through the window of the nursery, I saw the hearse that bore thee slow away, and turning from my nursery window, drew a long, long sigh, and wept a last adieu. Thy maidens grieved themselves at my concern, often gave me promise of a quick return. What ardently I wished, I long believed, and disappointed still, was still deceived, by disappointment every day beguiled, dupe of tomorrow, even from a child. Thus many a sad tomorrow came and went, till all my stock of infant sorrow spent, I learned at last submission to my lot. Though I less deplored thee, never forgot. You know, I do wonder when you know that, when you know that background, whether maybe it helps to explain one of the hymns that we often sing, Hark, My Soul, It Is the Lord. You know, there's a verse, isn't there? Can a woman's tender care cease towards the child she bare? Yes, she may forgetful be, yet will I remember thee. Well, in contrast to Cooper's lifelong memory of his mother, he says almost nothing about his father in his memoir. His father, Dr. John Cooper, was rector of Berkhamsted. He was chaplain to King George II. He was a clergyman, but there was no indication that he was actually converted. There's just one mention of him in Cooper's memoir. When he was 11 years old, his father gave him, can you believe this, his father gave him an article, a paper to read, called A Vindication of Self-Murder, a paper in defense of suicide, when he's 11. You're giving your 11-year-old boy a paper to read on suicide, asking him to give his considered opinion. And so Cooper took this to mean his father's silence on the issue. When William Cooper read the paper, as his father requested, and told him that he couldn't agree with this, even at 11 years of age, his father's silence, William interpreted to be his approval of that in circumstances. And maybe later on in life, as we listen to Cooper's life, maybe that will explain maybe why Cooper was not so bored at the idea of suicide. I think maybe he felt that his father possibly could have even approved. Well, just after his mother died, when William Cooper was just 6 years old, his father decided to send him away to school. And the school that he sent him to was in Markyates Street, near Luton in Bedfordshire, a school called the Old Vicarage, or Pitman's, Unfortunately, it sounds a bit like Pitbull, doesn't it? But Pitman's was, it kind of sums up everything. It was the classic kind of private school with its own school bully. It was run by a Cambridge scholar and clergyman called William Pitman, a friend of Dr. Cooper. And William Cooper's time there was unhappy, mainly because of a 15-year-old boy who was in the school, who made it his business to absolutely terrorize William Cooper. He says that he became the object of his brutality. We're not told what kind of abuse he suffered, but in his memoir, William Cooper writes, "My chief affliction in the school consisted of my being singled out from all the other boys by a lad of about 15 years of age as a proper object upon which he might let loose the cruelty of his temper. I choose to forbear a particular recital of the acts of barbarity with which he made it his business to persecute me. It will be sufficient to say that I had, by his savage treatment of me, he had impressed such a dread of his figure upon my mind that I was afraid to lift my eyes higher than his knees, that I knew him better by his shoe buckles than by any other part of his dress. May the Lord pardon him. May we meet in glory." Well, as it happens, the boy was eventually expelled, being too brutal even for Pitman's. In 1742, at 10 years of age, Cooper was sent to Westminster School. In contrast to his years at Pitman's, his time at Westminster, generally speaking, was very happy. They were happy years. He was there from 1742 to 1748, and he made lifelong friendships. He played sports. It really was the premier school to go to, far more than Eton College in those days. It was the school that the wealthy would send their children to, their sons to. And so he made lifelong friendships. He played sports. He wasn't the kind of effeminate man that you might imagine Cooper to have been with all of his frailties. He began keeping pets. He enjoyed occasional days out to popular sites like the Tower of London and Bethlehem Hospital for the Insane, Bedlam, which he said both amused and appalled him. Later, Cooper wrote about the religious and moral weakness of the entire public school system. He, in later years, very much was in favour of certainly home education and private school, of a Christian education. But he wrote about the moral weaknesses of the public school system, and he believed that whatever seeds of religion he carried with him to Westminster, they were all corrupted there. And he wrote, I quote, "The duty of the schoolboy swallowed up every other, and I acquired Latin and Greek at the expense of a knowledge much more important." So in these early years of his life, two great blows had deeply affected him. The first was the death of his mother and the way in which his father responded and dealt with him so harshly at that time, and then also the abuse that he suffered in school at Pitman's. Just before Cooper left Westminster School, his father arranged for him to become an apprentice to the law in 1748. 2 years later, Cooper was officially accepted into the Society of the Middle Temple. He was to be trained in law. It was his father's idea, not his own. And it was to be the next step towards a career in law or politics. Who knows, perhaps even becoming a future Lord Chancellor like his grandfather, after whom he was named, William Earl Cooper. In 1750, William was articled to a London solicitor in Ely Place, Holborn, Mr. Chapman. William's uncle, Ashley Cooper, lived in Southampton Row, which is now, of course, a busy commercial centre now, but his uncle, Ashley Cooper, lived there, who trained also at Middle Temple. He held a very influential position as clerk of journals in the House of Lords. And Cooper was eager to visit his uncle Ashley, not actually because of the influence that he exercised, but because he had three pretty daughters, Harriet, Theodora, and Elizabeth. And he spent far more of his time visiting the three girls, his three cousins, than he ever occupied at his chambers in Middle Temple. Women were attracted to William Cooper throughout his life. As the months passed, his relationship with Theodora became more serious. By 1752, the tension of their relationship had become too much. In many ways, Theodora and William, in many ways, they were very similar. They seemed to have some kind of family weakness in terms of their capacity for breaking down and depression. And so by 1752, it was all too much for William Cooper and for Theodora, and it, in fact, was the first of four major seasons of depression throughout William Cooper's life. Interestingly enough, for those who would know perhaps about clinical depression and so on, it seems that it's roughly in 10-year cycles that William Cooper suffers from serious bouts of clinical depression. And Cooper's relationship with Theodora continues from 1749 to 1756. By 1752, he was deeply in love with Theodora. Their relationship flourished. They longed to become engaged, but, of course, her father, Ashley Cooper, wouldn't give his consent to the marriage, and so the engagement, if they had been engaged, that, as some people believe, then the engagement was certainly broken off. And her father refused to give permission for them to marry. They never saw each other again after 1756. They never, literally never, had sight of each other ever again. They never communicated ever again. And yet, as William Cooper developed as a poet, then poems flowed from his pen. He wrote 19 poems, which if you read his works, you'll find 19 poems to Delia. Delia was his code name for Theodora. And the other thing as well is that although they never saw each other after that distressful hour when they parted, as William Cooper referred to it, she continued to follow his career as a poet, and in fact she continued throughout his life to send him gifts. And at one point in his life, he never ever knew this, but at one point in his life she even financially supported him with a salary. And William never knew that. This only emerges from a private letter from her sister, Harriet, or Lady Harriet Hesketh, as she became, from a private letter to a family member. That comes out in later correspondence. By 1756, Cooper had settled well into his chambers in the Middle Temple. Circumstances in his life were proving too much to bear. His relationship with Theodora, or Delia, had been broken during that year. His father died soon afterwards, leaving him without financial support, and upon which he had been largely dependent. And in addition, his closest friend from Westminster school days, by now Sir William Russell, drowned in 1756 while swimming in the River Thames. And as would prove so typical of Cooper in later life, he poured all of his energy and all of his anguish into one of his earliest major works entitled On the Death of Sir William Russell. Cooper was called to the bar in 1754, and around that time he helped to establish what was known as the Nonsense Club, made up of old Westminster boys. They met to discuss, basically it was a satirical and social comment sort of society. They met to discuss social and political issues of the day, such as the wrongness of men wearing wigs and makeup, such issues. And they would discuss and other much more important political matters as well. They would discuss these issues, and they would pass on social comment through satirical magazines like the St. James Chronicle and the Connoisseur. In 1762, Cooper was having serious financial difficulties. At 31 years of age, he was no further forward than when he'd started, in after 10 years in terms of a career in the law. It had been a bad choice for William Cooper. Cooper's cousin, Major Cooper, owned the rights to several lucrative positions in Parliament, including Clerk of Journals in the House of Lords, the Reading Clerk and Clerk of Committees. Major Cooper had long since promised to offer one of these positions to William when one of them became vacant. The post that Cooper really wanted was the Clerk of Journals in the House of Lords. Financially, it would have meant less income than the other two, but it carried the added attraction in that the other two positions required a public examination. And by disposition, William Cooper was terrified of having to do anything in public. You know, later on, when he's with John Newton, he's terrified to lead a prayer meeting. That's how he was by nature. And he couldn't bear the thought that he might have to be publicly examined. And so he opted to go for that particular position of a clerk of journals. But then he discovered that there was a group of men within Parliament who didn't like, they had an issue with the Cooper family. They were Whiggish in their tradition as a family and in their views. And so they called for a public examination in order for William Cooper to have that position. It was all proving too much for William. He could see no other option but to take his life. In deciding to commit suicide, Cooper bought some laudanum, a mixture of opium and wine, with every intention of poisoning himself, but he couldn't do it. 2 days before the day of the public examination, he took a coach to Tower Wharf to drown himself in the River Thames by Custom Quay House. Got there, discovered that the water level, the tide was low, and the water level was too low, and there was a porter sitting on the luggage, so he couldn't do it there. The next day dawned. There was just 1 day left before the great ordeal at the House of Lords. He went to bed that night, and waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning, he took out a knife with the intention of driving into his heart. The knife broke. The sun came up. He lay there until the sun came up that morning. And after 3 failed attempts to hang himself, during the last of which he came very close to succeeding, there was such a commotion, he threw himself onto the bed and wept and wept. A laundry maid, hearing the commotion, came to see what was wrong. Cooper told her the sad tale, and she went straight to Major Cooper, and he came at once, took away the paperwork relating to the clerkship, and he went straight to Parliament, and every prospect of working in the House of Lords was now gone. In the days ahead, William Cooper began to feel deep conviction of sin. Around this time, he wrote one of his bleakest poems, "Hatred and Vengeance, My Eternal Portion. Scarce can endure delay of execution. Wait with impatient readiness to seize my soul in a moment." Well, William Cooper remembered, he thought about his cousin, a powerful preacher, actually, an evangelical, Martin Madan, Calvinistic in his doctrine, powerful preacher. Previously, William Cooper had regarded his cousin Martin Madan with scorn. He was an enthusiast. But now he began to wonder, in fact, whether his evangelical cousin might be able to help him. Martin Madan came to visit him and, of all things, explained to him the doctrine of original sin. Told him that every man, woman, and child is guilty before God, that we sin by nature and by practice. Now, that may not seem like the kindest thing to say to a man that's just attempted to take his life. But in a sense, it was, because in its own way, it gave hope to Cooper. Because he began to think, well, if all men are sinful, and if the gospel is offered to all men, then maybe to him as well. So he began, perhaps for the first time, to think about his position, his state before God. Towards the end of 1763, after this bout of this serious time of depths of depression, Cooper's mental condition had become so distressing that his brother John had made the decision to place him in an asylum. But although that sounds terrible to us, it wasn't actually as bad as it may sound to us, because the asylum was in St. Albans. It was known as the Collegium Insanorum. It was run by a kind and a capable Christian called Dr. Nathaniel Cotton. Dr. Cotton was he was an evangelical man. He worshipped regularly at Dagnall Lane Chapel, which was later rebuilt. It was knocked down and rebuilt in Spicer Street. So those of you may know of Spicer Street Chapel in St. Albans. That's the origins of that chapel. And close in the proximity to that place was this asylum that was built to cater for between 5 and 20 patients. It was small enough to maintain a family atmosphere, which had been Dr. Cotton's intention. It was a far cry. It was radically different from the mental asylums of the day, like Bethlehem Asylum in London or Bedlam. Dr. Cotton had already established a fine reputation for successfully treating mental illness in a compassionate way. And moreover, although Dr. Cotton was a keen Christian, he never saw it purely as a means of getting the gospel to people. Although obviously as a Christian he was keen to promote the gospel, but he never forced the Bible or the gospel upon his patients. Bibles were made freely available in the rooms, and he made it clear that he was available to talk about spiritual matters as well, if they so desired. And so William slowly began to regain a more balanced state of mind until he was able to walk outdoors. He was allowed then to walk freely into the town and back, and his conversations with Dr. Cotton were proving helpful. In 1764, Cooper was walking in the garden of the asylum, of Dr. Cotton's asylum, one day. He found a Bible lying on a bench, sat down, opened it up, and he just happened to turn it to John chapter 11, where Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead. And Cooper said that as he read the account of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead, he began to feel hope in his heart that maybe Jesus can do something. Maybe Jesus can show him mercy in the way that he showed mercy to Lazarus. And as he read it, he said, "Oh, that I had not rejected so good a Redeemer, that I had not forfeited all his favors." And through this experience in the garden, Cooper's heart was softened. He was not yet converted. After this, Cooper tells us that having risen with somewhat of a more cheerful feeling, I went to my room where breakfast waited for me. While I sat at the table, I found the cloud of horror which had for so long hung over me was every moment passing away. I flung myself into a chair near the window, and seeing a Bible there, I ventured once more to apply to it for comfort and instruction. The first verse I saw was the 25th verse of the 3rd chapter to the Romans, concerning Christ, whom God hath sent forth to be a propitiation through faith in his blood, to declare his righteousness for the remission of sins that are passed through the forbearance of God. Cooper says, "Immediately I received the strength to believe it. The full beams of the Sun of Righteousness shone upon me. I saw the sufficiency of the atonement he had made. My pardon sealed in his blood, all the fullness and the completeness of his justification. In a moment I believed and received the gospel, and whatever my cousin, my friend Martin Madan had said to me long before, revived in all its clearness with a demonstration of the Spirit and with power. Unless the Almighty arm had been under me, I think I should have died of gratitude and joy. My eyes filled with tears, my voice choked with transport. I could only but look up into heaven in silent fear, overwhelmed with love and wonder." What an amazing conversion. Praise God for that. Cooper wrote a poem entitled, which he called "The Happy Change." The soul, a dreary province once of Satan's dark domain, feels a new empire formed within and owns a heavenly reign. William Cooper's troubles hadn't, and they weren't all to disappear. But at least he was now a new man under the reign of a new king, the Lord Jesus Christ. Following his conversion, Cooper was like a new man in a new world. His remaining days in St. Albans were happy. If he could have stayed there, he would, but he knew that he couldn't stay there. So in May 1765, he was ready to move. And it was decided that he should move to be near his brother, John, who by now was a clergyman in Cambridge. And so he felt that if he was near Cambridge, his brother could keep a watchful eye upon him and have contact with him. So he actually moved. He was on his way very soon to Huntingdon. And during his time in Huntingdon, Cooper was leaving church one Sunday morning. He was worshipping at a church, the Anglican church, across the road from the house in the high street where he was living. And as he was leaving church one Sunday morning, a young man, William Unwin, stopped him. William Unwin was anxious to know who this new person in the church was. So that afternoon they met to drink tea together. And Cooper found him to be so spiritually like-minded as an evangelical that he later wrote in his memoir his inexpressible joy in meeting him. On the following Sunday afternoon, Cooper was invited back with William Unwin. He was invited back to the family home in Huntingdon High Street. 18-year-old Susanna was the first to greet him, and then her parents, William Unwin's parents, the Reverend Morley Unwin, and his wife, Mrs. Mary Unwin. Bonds of love and friendship were quickly forged to the degree that within 3 weeks he moved into their home as a paying guest, as a lodger. He'd only been there for 4 months, and yet by the middle of November 1765 he was living with the Unwins almost really as a family member. It suited him well. They would read together, they read the Bible and pray together. Like many families at the time, they would read Philip Doddridge's The Rise and Progress of Religion in the Soul. And as time went by, it was actually Mary Unwin who became Cooper's closest companion. She was only 7 years older than him, and yet she became almost a mother figure to him. And they got on spiritually, they were very like-minded. In contrast to Mary Unwin, there's no evidence to suggest at this point that Morley Unwin was truly converted. He was a clergyman, but he was unconverted. On the 2nd of July 1767, while Morley Unwin, the father was on his way to lead public worship in Godmanchester, a Fenland town, he fell from his horse, fractured his skull, was taken to a nearby cottage where he lay until the following Thursday evening when he died. Morley Unwin was a Unitarian. He didn't believe in the deity of the Lord Jesus Christ or the Trinity. And to the joy of the family, just moments before he died, he acknowledged his need of salvation and he openly confessed his faith in Christ, saying his last words, "Jesus Christ is God and he can save me." Following the loss of Morley Unwin, it was felt now that it was necessary for them to move. William Cooper would move with them. He had become like a family member. And within a matter of days of Morley Unwin's death, Mary Unwin received a visit from a concerned clergyman some distance away. His name? Reverend John Newton. John Newton had heard of this family's loss. These two men would not naturally have been drawn together as friends. With William Unwin now at Cambridge and having moved away to Cambridge, it was felt that the best decision would be if they should move to sit under the ministry of John Newton in Olney. John Newton made inquiries and he managed to secure a place for Cooper and for Mary Unwin and Mary's daughter Susanna, with William Unwin now, of course, in Cambridge. And he found a place in need of renovation just off the marketplace in Olney. And until the house work was complete, they were invited to stay with John and Mary Newton in the vicarage. In September 1767, they moved as guests into the vicarage. until in December 1767 they were able to move into Orchardside, which to this day carries the memory of Cooper and Newton. Some of you may have been there. Of course, it now houses the Cooper and Newton Museum, and I'd warmly commend it to you if you've never been there. But the main trade in Olney was lace making, brought to the area in the late 16th century by French and Flemish Huguenots fleeing persecution. The extreme poverty of the lace workers soon became a matter of real concern. So William Cooper now becomes his concern for the poverty and for those who are starvation level in Olney and in surrounding district. The reason then for the Unwins and for William Cooper's move to Olney in 1767 had very little to do with the town itself. It was rather because they wanted to sit under the ministry and the pastoral care of the local curate, John Newton, who had moved there himself in 1764 through the influence of an evangelical Lord Dartmouth. And when Cooper and Mary Unwin arrived in 1767, Olney was already a focal point for evangelicals. You know, earlier on in the 1700s, the time at which William Cooper was born, 1731, was a, you know, England was in a sorry state as far as the gospel was concerned. You know, I think it was William Romaine could say that he only knew, in London at that time, he only knew of one other evangelical clergyman. You know, by the end of the century, there are literally hundreds. You know, it was a period of revival and awakening, of course, during the 1700s. But by this stage, by the time the Unwins and William Cooper had arrived in Olney, although it was a small market town, it was already a thriving hub as far as evangelical interest was concerned and evangelical activity and ministry. It seems an insignificant place, perhaps, to us, but for Christians, it was a major centre of evangelical preaching. The non-resident vicar there, Moses Brown, had arranged for many of the greatest preachers to visit the town. In addition to the regular preaching of just John Newton, in addition to John Newton's consistent ministry, other preachers to the town included Henry Venn, Andrew Fuller, William Romaine, Roland Hill, John Berridge, John Ryland Sr. and John Ryland Jr. And even, yes, there was somebody called George Whitfield. He preached there too. Thomas Scott ministered as later as a curate there. And William Bull was minister of the nearby Independent Chapel at Newport Pagnell and close friends of Newton. And apart from Newton's ministry at the Anglican Church of St. Paul's and St. Peter's in Olney, there were independent churches there too, thriving evangelical churches. There was the church which now is called Sutcliffe Memorial Church, the Baptist church there. In many ways, these were, it was John Sutcliffe, of course, it was later on, it was towards later on in the century that John Sutcliffe ministered there, who of course was a contemporary of William Carey. William Carey was also a member of Sutcliffe, what is now Sutcliffe Memorial Church. So William Carey was there later on as well. So what an incredible place to be for evangelical ministry. These were happy times. These were safe surroundings for William Cooper. Christian friends that he could walk with and talk with. But his time in Olney wasn't without difficulties. In November 1767, Mary Unwin was taken very ill. Cooper was convinced that the Lord was going to take her, that she was going to die. And on the 10th of December 1767, he was so concerned, he wrote to his aunt, Mrs. Madan, Martin Madan's mother, expressing his concern. He wrote, "Her illness, Mary's illness, has been a sharp trial to me. Oh, that it may have a sanctified effect, that I may rejoice to surrender up to the Lord my dearest comforts the moment he shall require them." Later in the letter, he shares with Mrs. Madan a poem he's just begun to write, following the impending, as he sees it, the impending loss of his closest friend, Mary Unwin. And I think maybe it's reasonable to assume that the poem was prompted by Cooper's fear of losing Mary Unwin. Oh, for a closer walk with God, a calm and heavenly frame, a light to shine upon the road that leads me to the Lamb. the dearest idol I have known, whate'er that idol be, help me to tear it from thy throne and worship only thee. The relationship between Cooper and Mary Unwin has been a subject of interest. People make all sorts of things of that. There was obviously much affection. They cared for one another, but there never was a suggestion of romance. And over the next 6 years, Cooper was kept very busy helping Newton in the work of ministry. In contrast to Mary Unwin's quiet, steady nature. But, you know, Mary Unwin, I might just add, was from a very cultured background. She was a very cultured woman. But she, you'd never know that, by all accounts. She was very much in the background, caring for William Cooper, understanding the frailty of his mind and of his heart. And in contrast to Mary Unwin, Newton was a force to be reckoned with. There's nothing quiet or unassuming about John Newton. He approached his work with tremendous energy. Sometimes he would be in the pulpit for as much as 6 hours preaching on a Sunday. When he wasn't preaching in the church, he would be visiting the sick, leading prayer meetings in cottage homes, in cottages, in meetings, teaching children, giving evening lectures, holding frequent worship services with dissenters. Frequently, when John Newton travelled to preach elsewhere, he would invite William Cooper to join him. And it's interesting to note as well that on occasions, Mary Unwin accompanied them and was asked to lead the public singing. And Cooper spent up to 8 hours a day in Newton's company, praying with him, visiting the sick, visiting those who were dying, visiting the poor lace makers in Olney, going into the most destitute of homes and the most difficult of situations. There were times when Newton would ask Cooper to help teaching in the Sunday school, and Cooper also assisted by writing special poems. John Newton loved to mark any special anniversary, even the anniversary of their arrival in Olney. The beginning of their prayer meetings at Lord Dartford's house, he asked John Newton to write a poem to mark that occasion, the anniversary when they first started having prayer meetings at the great house that was owned by Lord Dartford. And so he did. William Cooper wrote a poem to mark that occasion called On Opening a Place for Social Prayer. It begins, Jesus, where'er thy people meet, there they behold thy mercy seat. Where'er they seek thee, thou art found, and every place is hallowed ground. The midweek prayer meetings were held at Lord Dartmouth's great house, and although Lord Dartford himself was rarely there, rarely local, he would often ask Cooper to lead those meetings. And William Cooper, again in his memoirs, said that he struggled with such fear of making a public spectacle of himself. In fact, when Newton asked him to lead the prayer meeting, sometimes he would sit shaking for up to 4-5 hours beforehand, worrying about leading the public prayer meeting. And yet when he did pray publicly, it was said that his prayers were holy and intimate, as though the Lord were physically present in the room with them. One villager remarked years later, one man who used to attend those meetings said, "Of all the men that I've ever heard pray, no one equaled Mr. Cooper." Between the vicarage and Orchardside lay an orchard, it was known as Aspreys Orchard or Guinea Field because William Cooper and Mary Unwin rented it from a Mr. Asprey for a guinea a year. And there was a wall at the end of the garden. If you've been there, you'd know that there's a wall there that separates the rear of Orchardside from where it leads out onto the vicarage, Newton's vicarage. And so they had a gate put there. And at regular times, Newton would come through. And in the garden was this summer house, which you can still see, very wonderfully preserved in the garden at Orchardside. And John Newton and William Bull, and much to William Cooper's objection, William Bull, the minister from the Independent Chapel in Newport Pagnell, and John Newton, they would sit there smoking. And William Cooper objected to this practice of smoke inhaling. And for that reason, initially, he was very wary of the man that he called the smoke-inhaling bull. So during the 3 years following his brother's death, Cooper began writing more than ever. I ought to add at this time that it was in late 1770, William Cooper's brother died, and in fact, actually, although he wasn't, for much of his years as a clergyman, wasn't a professing believer, at the end of his life, he did, just before he died, he professed faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. In 1771, the clouds, storm clouds, were beginning to gather again. On the 1st of January 1773, as I mentioned at the very outset of this talk, William Cooper was out walking in the fields around Olney, and the fearful thought came into his mind like a warning that he was about to fall again into the depths of depression. Arriving home, he immediately put pen to paper and wrote a kind of poetic confession of his feelings. He had what he described as his fateful dream. And he wrote these words: God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Deep in unfathomable minds of never-failing skill, he treasures up his bright designs and works his sovereign will. Ye fearful saints, fresh courage take. The clouds ye so much dread are big with mercy and shall break in blessings on your head. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. His purposes will ripen fast, unfolding every hour. The bud may have a bitter taste, but sweet will be the flower. Blind unbelief is sure to err and scan his work in vain. God is his own interpreter, and he will make it plain. On the 2nd of January 1773, the day after, John Newton came to see Cooper and was most concerned about his condition. 2 weeks later, John Newton wrote in his journal, "My dear friend still walks in darkness. I could hardly conceive that anyone in a state of grace and favour with God can be in greater distress." And yet, said John Newton, you know, it's something when John Newton writes this, "and yet no one walked more closely with him or was more simply devoted to him in all things." You know, William Jay of Bath said that John Newton was the most Christian man he had ever met. And here is John Newton saying, I know of no one who walks more closely with the Lord than William Cooper. Before the end of February, Cooper's condition worsened, and he had, I mentioned a moment ago, he had what he described as his fateful dream, which he never ever forgot, and is one of the sort of most significant episodes in his life. He dreamt that he was in hell and that he had been abandoned by God. He never divulged the precise details of his nightmare, of his dream, and yet he often referred to the lasting impression that it made upon him. You know, he wasn't the kind of person to attach great significance to dreams and visions and things like that. But he did dream. He dreamt that God had appeared to him and said to him, "It is all over with thee. Thou hast perished." It reduced him to a state of despair. Cooper was convinced that God had abandoned him forever and that he felt himself to be finally without hope and utterly reprobate. Although the memory of that dream faded a little, it never really left him. And I think that it plays probably the most significant part in much of his life afterwards. Well, on the 12th of April 1773, with the annual fair arriving in Olney. Cooper felt that the peace and quiet of the vicarage would be much better than looking out onto the annual fair at the market square. So he went to stay, intentionally staying briefly with the Newtons, and in fact he stayed, and Mary Unwin, they stayed 13 months in the vicarage. And in selfless love and with no regard for the inevitable gossip, Mary Unwin decided to move out of the home to join them at the vicarage. You know, John and Mary Newton, if there had been anything improper in William Cooper and Mary Unwin's relationship, do you honestly think John Cooper would have had them living in the house? For 13 months, they lived with the Newtons. And it proved to be the answer that was needed. By October 1773, Cooper seemed so much better that the Newtons felt they were able to get away for a much-needed break, as you can well imagine, the first break that they would have been able to take since having them living in their home. And while they were away, Cooper again fell into the depths of depression, so that when John Newton heard about it, he abandoned the idea of a week's vacation and came back to care for William Cooper. In fact, he came back because Cooper believed that he must sacrifice himself through suicide. Well, the months passed and slowly Cooper's spirits began to lift. The strain upon Newton during this period was considerable, with a busy ministry, a thriving church, a 1,000 congregation, Sunday by Sunday. And nevertheless, he patiently accepted the difficulties. And by mid-May 1774, Cooper was sufficiently improved to be able to return back to Orchardside. During this time, it seems as if his depression had, in this instance, instead of generating energy and putting energy into writing, in fact, it completely crushed his ability to write at all. But he now began to take an interest in the arts of pruning, sowing, and planting. He began to take up gardening, fruits, and growing all kinds of fruit and vegetables. By 1779, Cooper began reading and writing poetry again. But very soon, another change was about to take place in Cooper's world. In 1779, John Newton wrote to William Bull, "My race in Olney is nearly finished." He had been offered and accepted a calling to the ministry of St. Mary Woolnoth in Lombard Street in the city in London. But with the impending move to London, Newton was understandably concerned about William Cooper. And so he asked William Bull if he would now take care, regularly meet with William Cooper. And so, in fact, they became firm friends, and that proved to be of great help to William Cooper. So in January 1780, John Newton preached his farewell sermon at Olney. Cooper missed him more than words can say. Thomas Scott was the curate at nearby Weston Underwood. Maybe you've read the little banner book, Force of Truth, which is Thomas Scott's autobiography. He was the curate at Weston Underwood, a village nearby, and it was Newton's recommendation that Thomas Scott should take over his ministry as curate in charge at the church in Olney. And during 1781, Thomas Scott settled into the vicarage. Although Thomas Scott had been greatly influenced by Newton, he didn't have, at least at this stage in his early on in his ministry, he didn't have the same kind of tenderness that Newton had. You know, it was said that in dealing with souls, it was said that Newton would apply the balm, would apply the poultice, that Newton cared lovingly with souls, but Scott applied the scalpel. He didn't have that same kind of tenderness at this stage and grace in his ministry, but they struck up a friendship. Well, it seems remarkable, you know, that William Cooper was 48 years old when he wrote the first of his best-known poems. These were good days for new poetry, like William Cooper's poetry. The best-known English poets had died in recent decades, including Henry Vaughan, Edward Young, I don't know if any of you know the ministry, know the work of the European Missionary Fellowship. I lecture occasionally. I do one course of lectures and until recently was on the board of the European Missionary Fellowship in Welling in Hertfordshire. In fact, Edward Young, the 17th century, 18th century poet, lived, in fact, the headquarters was his home. A prominent poet, he had died. Alexander Pope, most notably, had died. But unlike the classical poetry of Pope, there was something fresh, something contemporary about Cooper's work. It was also original. Cooper didn't read other poets. He didn't read poetry. And so it's not surprising. His poetry was very original. He wrote in a way that was unlike anyone else in his day. But one event was to take place that would bring, perhaps, be one of the greatest influences to bring to bear upon his poetry. On a summer's day in 1781, as William Cooper was gazing through the window onto the marketplace in Olney, he could see across the market square, the marketplace, he could see two women walking into a draper's shop on the other side of the market square. One of the women he recognised. She was the wife of the vicar of Clifton Rains, Mrs. Jones. But who was this other mysterious and very striking-looking woman? So he made inquiries. He learned that she was a sister to Mrs. Jones and she was the widow of Sir Robert Austin. Without thinking, typical of Cooper, without thinking about the appropriateness, he says to Mary Unwin, "Invite them for tea." And so that she goes and she finds them and she invites them for tea. And then, of course, William Cooper is filled with dread at the prospect of having tea with these women. The afternoon arrived. William Cooper was so apprehensive, Mary Unwin had to persuade him to stay for tea. But once the formalities were over, the conversation was flowing, he was amusing, they laughed at everything he said, and he was a great companion, and so they felt relaxed in his company, and very soon he was freely sharing his concerns with Lady Anna Austin, the widow of Sir Robert Austin. And she in turn was telling him all about herself. By late 1781, Lady Austin had to return to London. She was now Sister Anna to Cooper, and he was now Brother William. The lease on her home in London was due to end in the winter of 1783. And so before she returned to London, she made arrangements to move to Olney in 2 years' time. There can't be any doubt she was attracted to Cooper. It's obvious. Did William Cooper not understand that? You know, could he not see that? In his letters to John Newton, he shows something of his naivety. He wrote to John Newton with the good news that Lady Anna Austin is going to move to Olney. You know, this was an aristocratic woman. This was a woman who was more comfortable in the fashionable societies in London and Paris, not Olney. Didn't it occur to William that there must be something odd about her wanting to move to Olney? She was more at home in the fashionable circles in London and in French society. Her real motive for moving to Olney was to be near William. Of course it was. In July 1783, however, she made a great contribution to his poetry. She suggested that he ought to write something much longer than he had ever attempted. He said, "Like what?" Well, she pointed to the sofa, which is still in the Cooper Newton Museum. She pointed to the sofa. She said, "I don't know, write about the sofa." So he started a poem based on the sofa and the benefits of having a sofa if you've got gout. And after about 100 very formal lines of poetry, then he begins to move into what a privilege it is to be able to walk away and walk into the countryside. And then he begins to write poetry about nature and about how detestable many of the towns and cities had become. And he writes what arguably is his greatest work, which becomes known as The Task. And although it was Lady Anna Austin who originally suggested that he should write this major poem, it wasn't good news for Lady Anna Austin, because he became so absorbed with writing it, he forgot all about her. Whatever the reason, there was a definite breach in their relationship. In the spring of 1784, he sent Lady Anna Austin a letter in which he carefully explained, quote, "the circumstances that forced me to renounce your society." There was no reconciliation between them. Lady Austin left Olney for Bristol. She never saw Cooper again. She married a French gentleman and died in Paris in 1802. You know, if Lady Anna Austin had assumed that he had romantic feelings for her, I think it would be understandable. You know, 2 months before they parted and he wrote this letter to her, he wrote a poem. He had sent her a lock. He had cut a lock of his hair and given it to her, and she'd put it inside a piece of jewellery. And he wrote a poem entitled "To a Lady Who Wore a Lock of His Hair Set with Diamonds." This is what he writes. "The star that beams on Anna's breast conceals her William's hair. 'Twas lately severed from the rest to be promoted there. The heart that beats beneath the breast is William's, well I know, a nobler prize and richer far than India could bestow." You know, William, as far as William Cooper was concerned, it's just poetry. He's following poetic form. Can you blame her for drawing the wrong conclusions? Well, the departure of Lady Anna Austin had left something of a void in Cooper's life, and this was soon filled with a friendship with a new family, the Throckmorton family. Cooper came to know them. He lovingly called them the Frogs. The Throckmorton family were an immensely wealthy family that lived in, they owned really Weston Underwood, and they lived in Weston Hall, about a mile outside of Olney. It took some years for the friendship to ripen into maturity. They were Roman Catholics. William Cooper described the Throckmorton family as Papists, but much more amiable than many a Protestant. Before long, Cooper and Mary Unwin were now regularly dining with the family. They would walk across the fields to Weston Hall. One of the favourite stopping places was this alcove, which you can still walk to. If you go to Weston Underwood, there's a little, it's signposted, and you can walk to this little place that the Throckmorton family had built in their grounds. And he would write there, and some say that he, in fact, finished or completed part of the task there. So in the autumn of 1786, Cooper and Mary Unwin moved into a house owned by the Throckmorton family called Weston Lodge, in the grounds of, conveniently located within the village of Weston Underwood. And coinciding with the move, on the 29th of November 1786, William Cooper's friend, Mary's son, William Unwin, died of a fever, leaving a wife and two children. Cooper found himself unable to work afterwards, and the old symptoms of his condition began to reappear. His sleep was disturbed by terrifying dreams, accusing dreams. He would hear accusing voices. He had felt any assurance that he had of peace with God, any assurance of salvation, he felt had been swept away. And the loss of William Unwin proved too much to bear. And so in 1787, Cooper again, yet again, attempts to take his own life. Mary Unwin found him with a rope round his neck and rescued him from taking his life. And throughout the following months, as Cooper regained peace of mind, Mary Unwin was the one person that provided stability in his life. She was his tower of strength. Two other things in his life helped. His translation work. He threw himself through all of his energies into translating. He began from working from Weston Lodge. He began translating Homer's Iliad, exchanging his own broken world for the heroic world of Greek mythology, maybe helped his troubled mind. Also, the friendship of the Throckmortons. They didn't share his evangelical understanding, but they were kind people. although they were a nobility, yet he said that they weren't like the scandal-spreading gossips of high society. He did gardening and so on, and Mary Unwin received constant invitations to their home at Weston Hall, and they would play with the children, and they would eat with the family, and all of that was so helpful to him. In June 1791, Cooper finally finished his translation of Homer, and experience had shown him that he needed constant work to occupy his mind, at least to help him to stop dwelling upon his depressive condition. In October 1791, Cooper was approached by a publisher looking to produce a new edition of John Milton's works, wanted Cooper to edit it, and so he produced a scholarly commentary on John Milton's works and translations of his Latin and Italian poems. It was through his work on Milton that Cooper came into contact with another scholar, William Haley, the man who was to become such a devoted friend to Cooper in his remaining years. I ought to just to add that around this time that Cooper also became very concerned about the slave trade. In fact, Cooper was writing about the abuse, his concern about the slave trade 10 years before it was being picked up in Parliament. Well, Cooper received a letter from William Haley in March 1792. William Haley was writing on the life of Milton and thought that they could benefit by working together. Cooper was apprehensive, but once they met, they got on well together. They had many similarities, many things in common. William Haley had also studied law at Middle Temple before becoming a poet. William Haley had refused the offer of becoming poet laureate. Cooper's popularity had now been replaced by that of William Haley. Educated at Eton and Cambridge, William Haley was born into wealth, inherited a large house, which is now a private girls' school, a large house and estate at Eartham on the Sussex coast. His home became a meeting place for regular guests, including for artists and authors. So when William Cooper went there occasionally on weekends, he would meet with people like George Romney, William Blake, whose evangelical poetry had been greatly influenced by Milton and Cooper. Cooper himself stayed at Eartham for several months, and during the last 10 years of his life, William Haley committed himself to caring for Cooper, much as Mary Unwin had been doing. Well, that's Mary Unwin, aged 26, but by this stage, Mary Unwin's health had long since begun to fail. December 1791, paralysis down one side, and a loss of speech confirmed that she had suffered a stroke. She made a reasonable recovery, but in April 1793, she suffered another stroke. And although she survived it, she could no longer be the support that William Cooper needed. Previously, she had been at his side constantly, caring for him, looking out for him, helping him. But now he was having to care for her, which he did. At the insistence of friends, well-meaning but I think not entirely helpful friends, in July 1785, Cooper, Mary Unwin and their servants moved to Norfolk, staying temporarily at North Tuddenham. A permanent home was found for them, or at least it was intended to be permanent, at Munsley on the Norfolk coast near Cromer. They settled there, although Cooper was unnerved by the high cliffs and the rocky coastline. In fact, it's been suggested that the Munsley coast, with its rough high tides and rough seas, inspired Cooper to write his final poem, which was The Castaway, although we can't be sure of that. And from Munsley there followed a succession of house moves, which could not have helped William Cooper, really. And you just feel that he was at the mercy of a number of people. Lady Harriet Hesketh, his cousin, was insisting that he live here. John Johnson was insisting that he should live somewhere else. And these various people were contributing to this. And I don't think it was all terribly helpful. And shortly after their move to East Dereham, where they did finally settle, their final home in East Dereham in Norfolk. Shortly after the move, Mary Unwin's health began to fail. It was clear that she was dying. On the 17th of December 1796, Mary finally passed from this world to the next. John Johnson broke the news to Cooper, who appeared to accept it calmly. However, some hours later, he became distressed, protesting that she hadn't died, that she was still alive, that she would be buried alive if they buried her. John Johnson took him to the room to see her. He felt there was no option. And he looked at Mary and saw that she was no longer looking strained through illness or pain, but appeared calm and strong, like the Mary that he once knew. For a while he gazed at her, then he broke down and he wept inconsolably. From that moment he never mentioned her name again. She was buried by torchlight in East Dereham Parish Churchyard to prevent Cooper from seeing the burial. In the remaining few years of Cooper's life, one event is significant. In March 1799, as he sat alone thinking, he remembered a story he had read years before in Anson's Voyages. He had read a story of a sailor who had fallen overboard into the Atlantic, and other men had tried unsuccessfully, other sailors had tried to rescue him, and after a long struggle, he finally gave up the fight. And as Cooper thought about it, it occurred to him that this was a parable of his own life. He remembered that story, it stayed in his mind, and he thought that was a parable of his own life. Early in life, maybe as a five-year-old, on the death of his mother, he had fallen from the ship that carries most people from the cradle to the grave. His friends had tried in vain to rescue him. Mary Unwin, William Haley, John Johnson. Now here he was, exhausted, sinking. And suddenly his entire life, from the earliest moments in Berkhamsted, it became clear to his vivid imagination that he was the castaway. And he records in the final poem of that name, The Castaway. Obscurest night involved the sky. The Atlantic billows roared when such a destined wretch as I washed headlong from on board. Of friends, of hope, of all bereft, his floating home forever left. The final verse. No voice divine the storm allayed, no light propitious shone. When snatched from all effectual aid, we perished each alone. But I beneath a rougher sea, and whelmed in deeper gulfs than he. During the evening of the 24th of April 1800, Miss Elizabeth Perrone, who was a lady, I think she was about 24, she was caring for William Cooper as a servant and as a carer. She was looking after him. And 24th of April 1800, she could see that he was very weary. She offered him a drink. He responded, "What can that signify?" Those were to be his last words. He slipped into unconsciousness at 5 o'clock the next morning. Remaining in this condition until the afternoon, he died peacefully on Friday the 25th of April 1800, leaving this world to go to be with his Saviour and dearest friend, the Lord Jesus Christ. His friend John Johnson didn't even realise that he had died until he saw the expression on his face, which John Johnson described as, quote, "one of calmness and composure, mingled, as it were, with holy surprise." I think, was it John Newton, added that at that moment, William Cooper knew that he belonged to the Lord. One wonders if John Johnson would have thought of William Cooper's, one of his loveliest hymns, on seeing him. His face was one of calmness and composure, mingled, as it were, with holy surprise. One thinks of a hymn that William Cooper wrote. Sometimes a light surprises the Christian while he sings. It is the Lord who rises with healing in his wings. When comforts are declining, he grants the soul again a season of clear shining to cheer it after rain. For William Cooper, His final conflict was over. His body was laid to rest in East Dereham Parish Church. In the north transept of the church, a monument to Cooper can be seen. Underneath it are the words written by William Haley in the style of William Cooper. In memory of William Cooper, Esquire, born Hertfordshire 1731, buried in this church 1800. Yea, who with warmth the public triumph feel of talents dignified by sacred zeal, here to devotion's bard, devoutly just, pay your fond tribute due to Cooper's dust. England, exulting in his spotless fame, ranks with her dearest sons his favourite name. Sense, fancy, wit suffice not all to raise so clear a title to affection's praise. His highest honours to the heart belong, his virtues formed the magic of his song. On the site of the house where William Cooper lived for the last 5 years of his life in East Dereham, overlooking the Market Square, now stands East Dereham Evangelical Congregational Church. Outside the church, facing the busy Market Square, is a memorial stone bearing some appropriate words, perhaps the most appropriate words, from Cooper's greatest work, The Task. It reads, "I was a stricken deer that left the herd long since. With many an arrow deep infixed, my panting side was charged. When I withdrew to seek a tranquil death in distant shades, there was I found by one who had himself been hurt by the archers, and in his side he bore, and in his hands and feet, the cruel scars." Despite Cooper's feelings of being a castaway, it becomes clear that the God of all grace had been upholding him through his life, even in the most difficult times of moments of despair. And I think it reminds us of the importance of close friendships. Throughout Cooper's days, his friends were his lifeline in darkest moments. One thinks of John Newton, William Bull, John Johnson, William Haley. But of all the many devoted friends who played so vital a part in Cooper's life, I think the one person who deserves the highest praise, and I think the heroine, really, of the story of William Cooper's life, I think the one person who deserves the highest praise of all was his consistent and faithful companion, Mary Unwin. Quiet and unassuming, she emerges as the real heroine of the story. Selfless and worn out, she literally devoted herself to her dying day, caring for William Cooper. When Cooper realized that she was dying, he wrote a moving tribute to her entitled To Mary. It runs to 13 verses. Here are just a few verses, and I think they're fitting words with which to end this brief biography. The 20th year is well nigh past. He was writing a poem recollecting 20 years of being companions together. The 20th year is well nigh past since first our sky was overcast. Ah, oh, would that this might be the last, my Mary. Thy spirits have a fainter glow. I see thee daily weaker grow. 'Twas my distress that brought thee low, my Mary. Thy needles, her knitting and darning needles, thy needles, once a shining store, for my sake restless heretofore, now rust disused, they shine no more, my Mary. For though thou gladly wouldst fulfil the same kind office for me still, thy sight now seconds not thy will, my Mary. But well thou playest the housewife's part, and all thy threads with magic art have wound themselves about this heart, my Mary. Just very briefly, some lessons from his life. What can we learn from Cooper's life? And if there are other pastors here and those who have responsibility in caring for others, I think there are such valuable lessons to learn. Primarily, we need to reflect on Cooper's depression. William Cooper's depression deeply disturbs us as Christians. You know, we live in a very triumphalistic day, as you know, we don't like to think of such things as Christians. We don't want to think that Christians can get depressed and so on. But Cooper's depression does disturb us, and in our immaturity sometimes as Christians, we wonder how a Christian, a godly man like William Cooper, can be so overcome with despair and hopelessness through much of his life. He seems to have been plagued to the end of his days. How come? I think one lesson, the chronic depressive is often inconsistent about his despair. You know, to give an example, on January the 13th, 1784, William Cooper wrote a letter to John Newton affirming the truth about election and the perseverance of the saints. He believes that no believer, no Christian, can finally be lost. He doesn't question the reality of his conversion at the asylum in St. Albans. And yet, he's inconsistent, because although he believes that he was truly converted, although he believes that no true believer can ultimately be lost, he believes that all of that is true for everybody else except him. He's inconsistent with himself. There are times when he seemed to have some assurance of salvation, and yet there were other times when he believed that he was utterly reprobate and cast away. At various times, his despair is broken by periods of bright assurance. You know, that hymn, "Sometimes the Light Surprises a Christian While He Sings." Sometimes the Lord does bring a season of clear shining that follows a time of rain. And, you know, in the task, those words that are written on the memorial stone in East Dereham. "I was a stricken deer that left the herd long since, with many an arrow deep infixed." And he goes on in the task, and Cooper writes concerning the Lord Jesus Christ, "Ah, but he drew those arrows forth, healed me, and bade me live." So he knew that he was a child of God, and yet he goes through these periods of great depression. And he uses the word castaway in another of his poems called "Welcome Cross." "Did I meet no trials here, no chastisement by the way? Might I not with reason fear that I should prove a castaway?" I think we should understand that in his, you know, these were periods of mental illness. These were bouts of insanity. You know, these were periods of chronic mental illness, and during those times he questioned his and totally doubted his position before God. And yet he's inconsistent. You know, sometimes as a pastor, you know, I just say that, you know, I have a particular interest. My interest really in William Cooper is as a pastor. You know, that's really what attracted me to the life of William Cooper, because of having to deal with, often in almost any congregation, there will be those that are plagued with issues concerning assurance and depressive illness and so on. As a pastor, I think there are valuable lessons. You know, often I think of a girl in my own congregation, not a girl, a middle-aged lady now, who since the age of 18 has been plagued with depression. And every so often I will get a phone call and she'll say, "Paul, take my name off the church membership. I shouldn't be a member because I'm not really converted." And I have to say to her, "Look, come on. You know, we've been through this before." Of course she's a child of God. You know, and that is so typical, really, of this kind of a condition. So in dealing with souls, how often we find that the chronic depressive is completely inconsistent with themselves. But a second lesson, there may be understandable reasons for such a condition. His parents married in 1728. Before he was born, they'd already lost three children. Two children died after his birth, and then John was born. His younger brother was the last of the children to be born, and then his mother died 6 days later. 1736. It seems to be an unforgettable shock to William. The grief was lifelong. His father deals with him harshly, packs him off and sends him away, almost immediately sends him away to a school where he's bullied, where he's abused. what lessons there are for us fathers, you know, how much our children need to know how much we love them. In 1788, at 57 years of age, his cousin Anne Bodham sent a portrait that he never knew existed of his mother from Norfolk, which reveals the depths of his sorrow. Can a woman's tender care cease towards the child she bare? Cooper is silent about his father throughout most of his life. He recalls how strictly his father dealt with him, and then the abuse at boarding school, at Pittman's school, at the old vicarage. And then there's a sorrow when his heart is broken, when the relationship with Theodora is broken. There are understandable reasons, perhaps, for such a condition. Also, I think, another lesson, some of the sweetest songs come from the most bitter experiences. You know, we find that throughout William Cooper's life, there's a remarkable strength that seems to come to the surface. One of his biographers, Charles Reiskamp, who wrote a book published by Yale University Press, a much more kind of academic book looking at Cooper's work, Charles Reiskamp said that through all his trials, Cooper maintained an amiable character, except when depression crushed him to silence. He was gentle and kind and sweet-tempered, and out of this sweetness would come forth strength. You know, he had a remarkable gift for writing plain verse, which spoke clearly to the reader. He used it effectively, writing beautiful simple hymns. Many ways, you know, I think his genius was that he was a bridge between the classical highbrow poetry of poets like Alexander Pope and the romantics like Wordsworth and Tennyson and so on. So I'm not talking about Christian academics, but, you know, even non-Christian experts and scholars in poetry would recognize Cooper's genius as arguably one of the greatest poets that this country has ever known. But some of the sweetest songs come from the most bitter experiences. How often that is the case. One thinks of the letters of Samuel Rutherford written in prison, imprisoned for his faith, and of the benefit that they've been to Christians ever since to this very day. One thinks of John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress written in prison. One thinks of the diary of David Brainerd, which was so instrumental in Jonathan Edwards' life and in the lives of generations of missionaries ever since. So out of his suffering came the sweetest songs that have been sung ever since. You know, of all the lawyers that were at the Inner Temple at the same time as Cooper, I guarantee you not one of us would be able to name one of them. 30 biographies at least have been written of Cooper. That's the difference. And how helpful Cooper's sufferings have been for generations of Christians ever since. I think a fourth lesson, we should cultivate a healthy capacity for self-forgetfulness. There is a fine line between healthy self-examination, which the Bible does exhort us to engage in. It is one thing to engage in self-examination, to examine ourselves as Christians, but there's a whole world of difference between that and morbid introspection. Self-examination is a biblical thing. We're to use our minds to focus upon some reality outside of ourselves. Introspection diverts us from thinking about the great realities outside of ourselves. In Surprised by Joy, C.S. Lewis writes, "The enjoyment and contemplation of our activities are incompatible. The surest way of spoiling a pleasure or satisfaction is by examining it." You know, there's morbid introspection doesn't help at all. So we should cultivate a healthy capacity to forget about ourselves. How helpful it is and how health-giving it is to meditate upon great realities outside of ourselves. You know, is that why perhaps Cooper found it so beneficial to write about nature? He was preeminently the poet of nature and of creation. Is that why he found such solace in writing about creation? You know, is that why others too have found benefit in this? Jonathan Edwards, in writing in his personal narrative, the great theologian of revival in America in the 18th century, Jonathan Edwards writes about the benefits of meditating and dwelling upon nature and creation. He writes in his narrative, "I walked abroad alone in a solitary place in my father's pasture. for contemplation. As I was walking there, looking up to the sky and the clouds, there came into my mind so sweet a sense of the divine majesty and the grace of God that I knew not how to express it. C.H. Spurgeon, who himself knew something about depression, in lectures to my students, he wrote, typically Spurgeonic, he wrote, "A day's breathing of fresh air upon the hills or a few hours' ramble in the beech woods' umbrageous calm would sweep the cobwebs out of the brains of scores of toiling ministers who are not but half alive. A mouthful of sea air or a stiff walk in the wind's face would not give grace to the soul, but it would give oxygen to the body, which is next best." So there is a right use of nature for our mental well-being. And there are various incidents in Cooper's life in which you see that. I think number five, beware of the temptation to escape elsewhere. Occasional retreats into the countryside are helpful, are invaluable for our mental health, I'm sure. But it can't be right to want to spend your entire life as a recluse. Cooper was very recluse. He enjoyed company in Olney, but much of his life he was quite a recluse. How much better, perhaps, it would have been. You know, it's easy for me to say this. But how much better, perhaps, if he'd interacted more with others? How vastly different William Cooper is from William Carey. There is William Cooper, very much a recluse, examining his own heart. And there is William Carey, concerned about the multitudes in Calcutta who don't know Christ and concerned to go out with the gospel. Number six, we should remember how helpful a despairing life can be for the encouragement of others. You know, I think in church life, and ministers, it is so easy to only focus on the triumphalistic success stories. We love to talk about C.T. Studd and Hudson Taylor and Amy Carmichael and all these giants of the faith, you know, who overcame. But you know, sometimes Christians need to hear about the William Coopers. You know, it doesn't always do us good to hear only about the great triumphant Christians. Sometimes we need to. Doesn't Hebrews 11 remind us of that? Hebrews chapter 11, in that sort of portrait gallery of heroes of the faith, we read about those who overcame, those who shut the mouths of lions, those who triumphed. But we also read about others, it says in Hebrews 11, others who were stoned, sawn asunder, of whom the world was not worthy. It is helpful sometimes to read and to remind people of the Johnny Ericksons, the Corrie Ten Booms, the William Coopers. We should reflect upon William Cooper's friendship with John Newton. I think we should all seek to be a John Newton to some William Cooper. John Newton knew of Cooper's tendency to depression and reclusiveness, drew him into visitation as much as possible. He used William Cooper as much whenever he could. He would take him visiting. He would get him to write hymns. 1769, he suggested, "Why don't we work on our own hymn book together," which of course was published 10 years later as Only Hymns. He would use him and employ him. Lastly, number eight, we must frequently remind discouraged Christians of the mercies of Jesus. From time to time, you meet Christians who really do belong to the Lord. They say they believe and they know the truths of the gospel, and yet they find it so hard to believe that the promises of God apply to them. And they appear to be deaf to the comfort and the assurance that God's grace and mercy brings. I think John Piper helpfully brings this point out in one of his books. John Piper says that we should never cease to sing the gospel to the deaf and to tell of his atonement. It was the mercy of Jesus in John chapter 11, God's mercy in Christ to Lazarus, that first inspired hope in Cooper's heart and led him eventually to peace with God. And Cooper reflects upon that in his hymn, "There is a fountain filled with blood drawn from Emmanuel's veins, and sinners plunged beneath that flood lose all their guilty stains. There have I, he says, though vile as he, as vile as the thief on the cross, there have I, though vile as he, washed all my sins away. Christians need to hear the gospel. Believers need to hear the gospel. I don't just mean the ABC of the gospel, but believers need to hear the gospel again and again and again. Tell me the old, old story of Jesus and his love.
Can I say thank you to Paul for his very comprehensive journey through the life of William Cooper?